Pseudopod, episode 186, March 19th, 2010. This week's story, Angkor Sabot, by C. Deskin Rink. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from C. Deskin Rink. A particularly talented human organism, C is previously unpublished. Your narrator this week is Ben Phillips, who is previously unmortal. So, prepare to face the worst kind of monster, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Angkor Sabot by C. Deskin Rink. Seething eternally beyond the kin of sane and wholesome worlds lies the land of Angkor Sabot. To look upon its desolate ruin is to doubt the normal configuration of earth and sky, and to believe instead that the landscape has undergone an inversion and that a plummet into the nightmare infinities of an ultimate cosmic abyss is imminent. Singular and terrible is the sole disfigurement of otherwise unchanging tundra, a mountain composed entirely of dark obsidian. A mountain possessed of fearsome spires, terraced escarpments, and grotesque crags which beetle and shear to unthinkable heights. Crowning its impossible zenith is the black ziggurat of Zithaga, whose six-angled apex pierces hideously the uppermost reaches of a firmament which knows no hour except eternal midnight. Such is the dwelling place of Siasatep, the High Priest, a place unvisited by all save for unspeakable abominations and such men as are in the grip of irrevocable madness. But with a clear mind and purpose did Lord Galen of House Cornelius tread the powdery ash of Angkor Sabot. With purposeful strides did he follow the mosaic of an onyx staircase winding up the mountain to the black ziggurat itself. Ever and anon alongside the path, like titan headstones, there reared basalt megaliths topped by piled masses of dripping candles made from the tallow of unwilling sacrificial victims. Created by the candles' unsteady luminance, there danced a black kaleidoscope of shadows, some of which seemed to vacillate between concave and convex, with total disregard for chiaroscuro. Others appeared to walk or leap at intervals, which implied a sort of hateful intelligence. Through the funeral rows, a cold wind alternately moaned like a dirge or howled like mocking laughter. Though Lord Galen carried a repeater rifle of fine manufacture, he kept it unloaded and slung on his back, for even these loathsome surroundings affrighted him not. Though his joints ached with age and atony, he made haste. The search he had set out upon so long ago was nearly at an end. Many years before, when he was but a youth, Lord Galen met the incomparable Lady Fiona. She was a beauty distilled from the celestial spheres themselves, possessed of tumbling raven locks, cool viridian eyes, angelic curves, and opalescent skin that seemed to possess its own ethereal luminosity. Her laugh was water trickling down little silver bells, and her voice was the warmth of spring's beatific embrace. She understood him as no one else did. Oft-times they stayed up late together, engaged in long debates or the telling of stories. Although she was largely unskilled in the culinary arts, she frequently insisted on baking him pastries or other treats, and he, in turn, greeted her fumbling attempts with alacrity. To cheer him during his frequent gloomy fugues, she learned to sing and play the harp, and, though she never exhibited much skill, he loved her all the more for the effort. They were wed beneath the flower-draped arches of the many-pillared Grand Temple of Hecate, whose walls are scintillating jasper and whose belfries house ringing crystal globes. Together they presided over House Cornelius's domains with a firm but gentle hand. The peasantry prospered, the coffers overflowed, and the rival 1,001 houses grew to respect and admire them. But less than a year later, When Lord Galen returned home from a hunting trip, he discovered four of his guards torn limb from limb, his bedroom window broken in from the outside, monstrous claw marks on the second floor balcony, and of his beloved, no trace. Most disturbing of all was what he beheld graven into the wall above her bed, a monstrous blue sigil in the form of a six-lobed eye. No earthly implement could have rendered the perfectly aligned delineations of that unmentionable shape, nor could any earthly ink have provided its hateful color, which glimmered balefully even in total darkness. Terrible was Lord Galen's grief, but even more terrible was the thing which grew by degrees within him, his wrath. For many, many years thereafter, Lord Galen scoured the earth for his beloved. He traveled the perfumed fields of his native Great Malastar, where carnivorous flowers lure the unwary with succulent fruit. He sailed the churning waves of the Sea of Sorrows, where leviathans best left undescribed are fabled to heave. He braved the green depths of Ketrazar, where the great road to the netherworld is rumored to lie. He spoke to Shashan-Ra, who men call the Sorcerer. He questioned the vulpine Arden's Solar Storm, the greatest warrior mystic of the Dark Horizon tribe. He conversed with the arcane scholars of the prestigious Benediction University. But nowhere did he hear tell or catch a glimpse of a single glyph or rune which resembled the monstrous six-lobed eye. Frustrated and enraged by his futile wanderings, and with the treasury of his house sorely depleted, he unleashed a pogrom against his own peasantry in a desperate attempt to root out any who might be sorcerers capable of conjuring the blue sigil of the six-lobed eye. In one particularly brutal incident, Lord Galen had a score of mystics, soothsayers, midwives, and herbalists burned alive when none would confess. Such actions could not go unnoticed, and the next day the newspapers were agog over the massacre. The Council of the Thousand and One Houses was quickly convened to declare Lord Galen no longer fit to rule. Thereafter, a coalition of soldiers attacked his manorial complex, and Lord Galen managed to escape only with his life and his six-chambered repeater rifle. Across barren moors, scalding calderas, sacerdotal forests and parched grasslands did he flee until he reached the many-templed city of Saturnine, which rises above the sapphire waters of tessellated lagoons. The flower of his youth long since withered, Lord Galen spent the next three lustrums skulking through lichen-bearded back alleys like a common gutter rodent. He preyed upon the weak when he had to, but for the most part took to hunting down the manifold priests and hierophants residing within Saturnine's damp walls. Many of the clergy of Aten, Maat, Osiris, Bast, and Heket perished slowly beneath Lord Galen's bony claws, yet none knew or confessed aught of the unspeakable blue sigil. Finally, a priest of Anubis, after he had lost too many body parts to bear, blubbered and sobbed of how the sigil of the six-lobed eye was no symbol belonging to a wholesome and sane pantheon, but a blasphemous rune used to invoke the favor of the foul other god, Zathaga. Before being mercifully gifted with death, this priest told of Zathaga the unspeakable, Zathaga the hermaphroditic, idiot deity who came to the earth in antediluvian cycles from the cold worlds beyond the expanse of rational space and time. Zathaga, who listens eternally to the low booms of hateful bells, and who dwells always amidst the unlitten and nameless chambers of the nightmare castle of the 13 abyssal pylons. Zathaga, who holds jealously the black secret of Nothoth Yaman in its shapeless appendages, and in its mindlessness scorns it. Before expiring, the priest confessed that Zathaga's grotesque worshippers were wont to abduct the fairest of maidens for use in their unhonorable rites. These unfortunate girls were hauled over the wretched ashen leagues of the land of Ankor Sabbat to a mountain of razor obsidian, to the black ziggurat, wherein broods the bloated high priest Siasatep. Nigh 7 years were required for Lord Galen to finally locate the blasted lands of Ankor Sabbat, for the priest had known little of their whereabouts save that they lay somewhere beyond the 40th Arctic parallel. But eventually, Lord Galen came to a horrid village of low stone hovels filled with inbred tenants who'd greeted him in detestably apish fashion. Terrible were the filthy children who pawed incessantly at his snowy beard, but worse still were the women who lasciviously caressed his wrinkled face whilst emitting amorous hoots. The stooped archon of that benighted place grunted fantastic tales of a mighty obsidian mountain that lay over the horizon, and Lord Galen knew that at last his journey was nearing its end. Very soon he would recover his beloved into his arms. As he crossed the never-ending tundra of ash, time quite ceased to exist. In the sky above, the sun, moon, stars, and spheres appeared never and not at all. Neither day nor night came, and for a time a diffuse twilight reigned always. But eventually, even that faint gray phosphorescence waned till it gave way utterly to an all-consuming darkness. Ash clogged his throat, and he quickly drained what little water he had managed to bring with him. Yet through it all, he kept his head upright and scanned always the distant shadows for the obsidian mountain which was thrown to the black ziggurat of Zethaga. When at last he reached it, he felt in his heart a glimmer of a sensation he had not felt since his long-departed youth, something he could almost recall as hope. Swiftly did he pass the horrors which crowded obscenely the base of that obsidian mountain till he stood, at long last, before the league-high bronze gates of the black ziggurat. Almost greater than the mountain itself did that cruel edifice seem to tower, each frightful tier made up of thousands of cyclopean blocks, individually of greater dimension than Lord Galen's entire manor. With a groan that became quickly muffled by the ash-choked air, the mighty gates parted. Relative to themselves, they had opened only the barest crack, but it was more than sufficient to allow 6 men walking abreast to enter. Though no light issued from within, Lord Galen strode forward resolutely and without fear. He did not so much as tremble in the slightest when the colossal doors clanged shut behind him. For an interval which stretched to a veritable eternity, he traversed a hallway pillared by gargantuan ebon towers, whose abacuses and capitals were so high and distant that they vanished into illimitable blackness. From behind these columns, Lord Galen could, ever and anon, detect the faint patter of uncouth feet. Over time, he got the distinct impression that whatever creatures manufactured the sound also followed him. With each step, a stench like old sweat and fresh fecal matter waxed increasingly noxious until it exploded to a climax when at last the limitless corridor came to an end. The passage swelled abruptly into a monstrous chamber possessing 6 corners and tiled by immense hexagonal flagstones. In the center, there dominated an ebon throne which stretched nearly to the unseen arches overhead, and upon the base of which was graven the blue sigil of the monstrous 6-lobed eye. Of creations most hideous and grotesque, there sprawled upon that throne the Lord of all, a quivering vastness of pinkish flesh that approximated both a greasy amoeba, a heap of raw gristle, and a distended human caricature in equally revolting degrees. The great high priest Siasatep, most favored and blessed vassal of dread Zethaga. From behind the surrounding pillars there emerged a throng of pale, misshapen creatures, each no larger than a child. They cavorted ghoulishly upon their hind limbs and squirmed obsequiously upon their flabby bellies before the throne and their unspeakable master. Lord Galen's powers of speech deserted him entirely. He had steeled himself for anything, but the unlimited loathsomeness of the high priest proved entirely beyond the pale of even the most harrowing legends. Then by degrees, from the uppermost portion of the high priest's corpulence, like an abortion wriggling from a distended womb, there protruded slowly a bulbous roundness crowned by a stringy mass of oily black hair. Two pupilless yellow eyes rolled open, and a gummy, lipless mouth emerged to scowl. In a voice possessed of a disturbingly gelatinous vibration and of a thunderous bass pitch that rattled the flagstones, the high priest spoke thusly. "Look upon me, O Galen, and tremble rightly, for you are but a wretched insect before my never-ending glory. Long have I sat upon this smoldering throne of ebon and jet. For eons untold I have resided within these vaults, communing in dreams with the All-Father and All-Mother, whom this age knows as Zithaga. In my infinite mercy I have deigned to suffer your continual drawing of breath, so long as you prove an entertaining diversion from my eternal contemplation. It is for this reason, and this reason alone, that I have taken pity upon your pathetic life and allowed you to reach my abode alive and unharmed. Know that your desires are as an open book to my limitless intellect. You have come here seeking that which belonged to you so long ago, the girl you call Fiona. Fortunate are you, wretched insect, for she lives even after all these years, and as of yet has not been sundered utterly in fulfillment of both my carnal and gastronomical desires. Since your insignificant and puny emotions amuse me, I will allow you to recover the girl, so long as you can distinguish her from the other members of my harem." Before the fearsome bulk, and before the equally fearsome voice of the high priest, Lord Galen felt his previous courage slip away. He could only dumbly acquiesce to the doubtful proposal with a short nod. A lumpen appendage, which Lord Galen had initially taken as gestalt with the high priest's immensity, emerged to make a gesture. In response, the parade of pale abominations cavorting near the throne's base wailed in a chorus of multitonal voices, some high like the squeaking of mice, some low like the rumble of bulls, chanting over and over a maddening benediction. Zithaga. A group of them broke away to scurry off into the darkened rows of pillars and returned a moment later, goading forth a creature of approximately human configuration. Though she possessed the bare upper torso, arms, and breasts of a beautiful woman, she lacked eyelids entirely, and her pupils were so wide that her ocular orbits appeared empty. In the place of a mouth, there chattered a bony beak replete with rows of shark-like teeth. Her legs looked as though they had been reduced to the consistency of wax and then melted together to form a single appendage upon which she hopped awkwardly. Again the high priest spoke. "Look now, O wretched insect, and behold, this is Elamia, taken from her subterranean abode in the phosphorescent realms, lurking just below the feet of mortal men. She is regarded as the most beautiful of her kind, and it was for this reason that I desired her. Long ago did my servants raid her burrow and bear her hither to me. Perhaps she is the one called Fiona, who belonged to you so long ago." Lord Galen could only look away in revulsion and stutter that she was not his Fiona. To this the high priest chortled and ordered the Lamia taken away. With a second gesture, the high priest's foul servants receded once more. This time they bore thither an object which Lord Galen at first took for some sort of fiendishly wrought and highly abstract wax sculpture affixed to a wooden frame. But when they dragged it nearer, he could see that it quavered and heaved with a sort of horrible breathing. Only after studying it in stupefaction did Lord Galen realize, as his gorge rose within him, that the sculpture was no sculpture, but a living woman knotted about the wooden frame. He could see now, in frightful starkness, how her mouth had been distended to form a toothy lattice, how a single eye darted about in torturous comprehension, how arms and legs had been reshaped into fan-like new forms, and how other parts of her anatomy had been modified in ways not to be described. "Look now, O wretched insect, and behold, this is a mortal woman plucked from one of the teeming kingdoms of men. Her fairness was known to all across the land and was regarded by many to have no rival. Hearing these rumors, I dispatched my servants to abduct her from the palace in which she dwelt. But upon regarding her for the first time, I grew dissatisfied with her rather commonplace appearance and so chose to improve upon it. Perhaps she is the one called Fiona, who belonged to you so long ago?" Covering his mouth was all Lord Galen could do to keep from retching in disgust. He managed a feeble shake of his head, and the high priest's servants ushered her away. Anon they brought in, one at a time, a multitude of additional things which only madmen would dare regard as women. The abominations eventually progressed past the ability of mortal man to bear. Stringy effigies which bore awful human kinships and spoke from artificial orifices. Carrion heaps which had perhaps been human but were now exaggerated to gruesome proportions by arcane surgical techniques. Insectoid or reptilian females, which were the product of miscegenation between human and animal stock. Yet, blessedly, none resembled even in the slightest his beloved Fiona. After the last had been dragged away, the high priest chortled and then addressed Lord Galen once more. "Oh, wretched insect, it seems that no single member of my harem has pleased you. But despair not, for there is yet one left. She is a radiant jewel whose intellect and features have impressed even such an individual as I. Thus, after stealing her away many lustrums ago, I encased her in a mighty alembic which is host to a great many arcane engines. These eldritch devices have preserved her youth and splendor despite the passage of time. Yet hers is the beauty of the gardened amaranth, never wilting, but always kept jealously confined. Throughout the long years, she has retained her consciousness and experienced each moment of entombment with perfect clarity. Perhaps she is the one called Fiona, who belonged to you so long ago?" From the consuming shadows, the multifarious servants of the high priest dragged forth a prodigious apparatus in the shape of a cylinder perched atop a truncated pyramid. Coiled around its base were sinister bundles of cable and wire that suggested metallic intestines. From its edges there emitted a faint glow possessed of the sizzling qualities of electricity. A hidden lever caused a devilishly concealed panel upon the surface of the cylinder to slide open, and from within there tumbled the white form of a nude girl. For a time she lay upon the cold flagstones, coughing and sobbing. Then she peered up at Lord Galen with green eyes, obscured behind a curtain of dark hair. Upon seeing him, she gave pause and then issued a choked cry. She groped at him drunkenly and stammered indistinct words from half-numb lips, her long imprisonment within the alembic having obviously impaired her motor functions, at least temporarily. Any hope Lord Galen had dared entertain died in his chest then. Though the thing that crawled piteously toward him did indeed approximate in the vaguest sense his long-lost Fiona, it could not possibly have been her. While true that it possessed black hair, its hair was not the tumbling raven locks that Lord Galen remembered. And while true that it possessed eyes of green, they were not the cool viridian that he recalled. Its croaking voice was nothing near the spring-like warmth of long-lost Fiona's, and its form was that of a banal adolescent, and possessed nothing akin to long-lost Fiona's angelic curves. In his heart, he felt neither the peace nor the joy he recalled, but only a vague disgust. Whatever this thing was, it was not his Fiona. It had to be some sort of false simulacrum, fabricated by the vile sorceries and thaumaturgies of the High Priest. Lord Galen cursed the High Priest for lying to him and for toying with him so cruelly. Fiona had never been amongst the gruesome harem. The entire episode had been a game designed to entertain the High Priest at his expense. Without a backward glance, Lord Galen strode angrily from the throne room. Throughout the hallway there chased him, snorting, cackling, echoing at ever-waxing chortles. When he reached the great bronze gates, he found them surprisingly ajar, and quickly slid betwixt them and started back down the mountain. The Hierophant of Anubis he had tortured so many years ago had been false with him. His Fiona dwelled not within the lands of Angkor Sabbat. With a mighty oath, Lord Galen resolved to kidnap 100 more priests, 1,000 more if need be, and inflict such hideous cruelties upon them that the very gods would weep. Eventually, one would know where his long-lost Fiona had been born. Back in the Cyclopean throne room of the Black Ziggurat, the High Priest Siosatep's laughter continued. With a gesture, he ordered his servants to return the girl to her confinement, now more aware than before, as of one who is slowly coming out of a drugged stupor or nightmare. She began to scream at the prospect of more eternities within the claustrophobic dimensions of the Alembic. But the misshapen servants overwhelmed her easily, and as the panel slammed shut once more, the High Priest chortled louder. Soon after, his gurgling laughter lifted to a booming crescendo that shook the very foundations of the Black Ziggurat, but not before he spoke thusly. "Oh, wretched insect! Oh, fool! Oh, blind man! To you I spoke no falsehoods. The Alembic worked as I described, and the long years have changed her not. For it is you the years have changed. You who are no longer the same man who loved that girl so long ago. And in your irrecognition, you have scorned her and doomed yourself to search the world in vain until the end of your days. In the final and ultimate moment of your miserable life, you will at long last understand. To you she never belonged. All that was, all that is, and all that will be is forever a part of the dark kingdom of Zithaga."
Timeless, ageless quests have just one problem. They take time. The moment we embark on anything from a fitness regime down to a quest for fire, all we're actually doing is voluntarily evolving. We know the process will change us, we know that we may not be able to go home after it's done, and we do it anyway. Why? Is it because the Grey Havens are lovely this time of year? No. Sometimes we act for glory, or an ideal, and those are two of the most dangerous things anyone can act for, or on. Because ideals are like the questing beast, something we can glimpse, but we can never catch. They always run towards the horizon, or always just out of reach. Ideals are the rocks we break ourselves on, and far too many people do just that and end up as alone, as blinkered, as the main character does here. So why bother? Why quest? Well, firstly, fire's awesome, and secondly, because the whole point of life, I feel, aside from biscuits and cereal, of course, is to learn. Shine a light on our inner selves, learn what we do when we're in a bind, how we react. Except, most of all, that we will not like some of what we see, and see if we have the courage to change the things we don't like. Life's hard. Sometimes life is impossibly hard, but it's also complex and challenging, and if you're lucky, massively rewarding. I'm not going to buy into the even failure is a success thing, because with all due respect to Edison and his 2,000 failed light bulbs, failure is cripplingly depressing. But failure never lasts, and we recover from failure, and when we do, the first place we look is the horizon, and what lies beyond it. To the glorious quest, my friends, may we all find what we're looking for. Yes, even you, Bonnie. like money, for example, which we're looking forward to pay our authors and server costs. We rely on you to cover these, so if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise every single cent is appreciated. I also promise that none of those cents are haunted, unlike some of our t-shirts. A small portion of Pseudopod's t-shirt run seems to have been, how can I put this, possessed. The audio player depicted on these shirts uses distressed font and extra disturbing art. They're priced at a discount if you're brave enough to handle the concept of possessed supernatural clothing, so someday, assuming you live, you could tell your grandkids that you were there when it all went down, and you have the shirt to prove it. They're available only in size large while supplies last, and only 5 people in the world will own this version of the shirt. Hit poddisc.com to order your very own. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod is, and always will be, happy to dream the impossible dream.